Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. It's been said the Democrats can snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. The government shutdown has come to an end without the Democrats getting what they wanted, which was an extension of health care subsidies. They settled for a promise of a vote on that topic in mid-December. And while the talk of Washington should have been the end of the shutdown, it was largely overshadowed by the release of emails and other documents related to President Trump's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. To talk about everything that happened just yesterday, we have with us Ken Rudin, the host of the Political Junkie podcast. Welcome back to All Sides, Ken.
Thanks, Amy. A two-hour show today, 3 hours? What am I going to do?
Just for yesterday. I know,
yeah, right? Right, exactly.
And I understand it's your birthday, so I have to say happy birthday. Did you ask for the Epstein files or the end of the shutdown as your birthday present this year?
I asked to be on All Sides with Amy Jurevich.
Well, then wish granted. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Okay, so the plan, let's start with the government shutdown. We can save the documents for later. The government shutdown. The plan came from 8 Democratic senators, some who are retiring, others who don't face re-election, and they voted with the GOP to advance plans to fund the government through January. Now, this is going to restore SNAP benefits as well for longer than January. And in exchange, there will be a vote on Obamacare subsidies in about a month. So what would you say? You know, this hasn't been very popular with the Democrats who were enjoying a victory lap after the election from a week and a half ago. So did the Senate Democrats break down for nothing?
I don't know the answer. And it's a fascinating question. And I don't think anybody knows the answer right now because it's a lot of wait and see stuff. But definitely the Democrats were on a roll. I mean, the poll showed that numbers for Trump, the job approval was fading. People were just suffering. There was a CNN tracking poll that showed the Republicans really hurting. And then, of course, we saw the Democrats sweep the elections, last Tuesday. And so why give up what they had, what they seemed to have? But other Democrats, among the 8 who caved, if you want to call it caved, they said, look, Trump is not going to give in on anything. People are really suffering. And sure, we could we could stay out just as long as they can stay out. But we really feel that people are really, really hurting and this shouldn't just go on. So the point is, yes, the Democrats caved. Yes, they snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. But at the same time, the problems that still exist, the problems that are still there still exist. Costs are high. Inflation is high. There's still no health care subsidies. Sure, they promised to vote, but who knows if, first of all, who knows if the House will take it up and who knows, what any of those promises mean. And the fact is that if the Republicans refuse to allow that vote on the tax credits for the ACA for, Obamacare, well, you have a midterm election coming up where both the House and Senate seem to be in play. I mean, I'm not convinced that the Senate can turn over, but who knows? I mean, if there's enough anger. So, yes, the headlines seem to be that the Democrats once again failed and they gave up and they conceded defeat without getting what they wanted. But at the same time, there are a lot of problems that the Republicans and Trump have not dealt with and solved. And I don't know if really much changes, except for the fact that so many people, the air traffic controllers, so many people are now getting paid. And that was the big story and the big concern by Democrats.
Do you think that this vote, which it seemed like a handshake agreement, I don't know. I mean, it's very public. I mean, they're saying there will be a vote in mid-December. Will it happen? Or is Mike Johnson going to block it?
Well, I don't know, exactly. I mean, Mike Johnson does what Donald Trump tells him to do. It's just, fascinating. He, like, for example, says, look, I don't know anything about the Epstein files, just to get off that subject for one second. I don't know anything about it. And the next time we turn around, James Comer of Kentucky is having a press conference with Mike Johnson right by his side, saying that Bill Clinton met with Epstein 7,000 times on his plane, on his island, on this and that. So for somebody who doesn't know anything about the Epstein files, he sure knows it when Bill Clinton's name is there. So Mike Johnson will do what he wants, and then do what, I'm sorry, do what the president wants. But it's just fascinating that they seem to have Trump seem to have joy of the people suffering and not seeing the optics of what was going on. I mean, you know, between the rebuilding of the East Room to have they had this great Gatsby party in the at Mar-a-Lago with, you know, the richest of the rich, while people are suffering, while people are not getting SNAP benefits, you know, food stamps, while the air traffic controllers are calling in sick and people are just afraid to fly. So there's a lot of optics that the Trump and the Republicans just didn't seem to be concerned about. And you know, the ball is still in their court. They still have the votes. They still have the House and the Senate. They still have the presidency. But I think what we saw in the elections, what we saw, and basically in the resolving or the current resolving of the shutdown, is that they still seem to be on the defensive. And look, for all we know, if this solving of the problem extends only until January, and we go through this all over again. Well, if the Democrats are not going to get anything of the things they promised, well, they may not go as quietly as I did this time. So I still think the Democrats have the momentum and have the arguments on their side, and we'll see if there is someone in the Republican Party who is smart enough to realize that they risk much more than a few elections in 2025, if they keep going on the same path.
And why are so many people openly criticizing and mad at Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer? Is it because did he like let those eight Democrats flee him or something? Like,
Well,
why
it's
is everyone
interesting
so
because
mad at him?
he was among the eight. Yeah, and it's interesting. I saw an article, I think it was in the Times, that basically said, look, somebody has to take the heat, and why not Chuck Schumer? I mean, nobody, Chuck Schumer doesn't seem to be anybody's favorite. This is it's everybody is seems to be convinced that if he doesn't run again in 2028, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will challenge him in the Democratic primary. If the unlikely event that the Democrats win the Senate in the 2026 midterms, would he come back as the Democratic leader? A lot of Democrats say no, we need new blood, as we saw in the elections and, you know, in around the country, especially in New York City. So I think, I don't know what the look. It's always good to be angry at somebody, and maybe he's the only best target. He, Chuck Schumer, is the best target and the most visible target. But I don't think, I kind of think that for had the Democrats not acted, we would have gone through Thanksgiving, and we would have gone, you know, more and more flights being canceled and vacations being thwarted, and Trump again will still hold his parties in Mar-a-Lago and not seem to care. So, you know, again, I don't know who wins, you know, in the small W in the in November of 2025, but in the long run, it seems to be the right thing. Maybe not every Democrat agrees with that.
Conventional wisdom is telling me that government shutdowns don't work, not an effective tool to advance your agenda. So, why do they keep happening?
Well, I mean, they do seem to be happening. They do seem to be happening under Donald Trump, because that, you know, before this one, the longest one in history was in Donald Trump's first term. But I kind of think that rather than is this about, you know, tax credits for Obamacare and extending the tax credits and making health care affordable? It just seems to be, well, Donald Trump insists on getting his way, and he doesn't seem to compromise. He always talks about the art of the deal, but he only seems to deal in all these wars that he pretends to be solving around the world, and not wars between Democrats and Republicans. He doesn't concede, he doesn't negotiate, he doesn't you know, just give up anything. And he seems to enjoy that fight, but again, he can't enjoy the numbers he's seeing both in the election returns of Tuesday and the CNN poll, which I said shows him in the 30s, which is the lowest he's ever been.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. So everyone said the government shutdown was so long, in part as a distraction from the Epstein files. And then on the final day of the government shutdown, suddenly more Epstein documents are released. Democrats disclosed emails that suggest President Trump knew more about Epstein's sex trafficking than he previously acknowledged. And then a few hours later, House Republicans released 23,000 pages of documents. Why now? Why yesterday? Why?
Well, you know, see, it seems like the shutdown was pushing the Epstein story off the front pages, and the Democrats were not happy about that. And I think, you know, whether everything Donald Trump does is a distraction from Epstein, I don't really believe that's true. But it does seem like every time an Epstein story gets on the front page, he's, you know, off flying somewhere, or he's you know, addressing, you know, a group with this group, or passing some kind of bills. I mean, passing some kind of executive action that you know, that. Basically, he's doing whatever he can to get Epstein off the front page. And the fact that no longer is the fact that the shutdown is no longer hogging the headlines, this is the perfect time for the Democrats to bring it back. And it's clear that the Republicans are nervous, because Trump called Lauren Boebert, who suddenly has become one of the Trump real critics about Epstein, and said, look, you got to get your name off this petition to force a vote on releasing the Epstein files. And then Department of Justice officials met with Boebert this week, you know, to get her off this topic. So they're clearly nervous. For all the times that Caroline Levin says there's no there, they're obviously nervous as heck, because they know that if a vote in the House comes and Mike Johnson is forced to have a vote on, you know, on opening up these files, it's only going to just, you know, come off as, you know, just miserable for Donald Trump, especially given the volatility of what we saw this week, or what the Democrats released this week in the files.
I wanted to ask you the difference between documents and files then, so that I understand what's happening. So basically what was released yesterday are just a bunch of documents that a House committee had, but the files that everyone wants are from the Justice Department investigation. Is that right?
That's my understanding, but it is interesting that, you know, what the Democrats released with these emails from, I guess, Michael Wolff, the journalist, between Epstein and himself, or between Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, and all these things that basically Donald Trump spent hours with one of the young girls who was under question at Mar-a-Lago, that Donald Trump knew about the excesses of what Epstein is accused of. And Epstein seemed to acknowledge that in the emails. So I don't think you could have enough distraction. As long as there are a handful of Republicans, and that remains to be seen if that's going to continue, but as long as you have a handful of Republicans who are willing to continue to keep this issue in the forefront, it's not going to go away. I still can't imagine how it's going to end, but I think the only way it's going to end is that the only way it's going to ever be resolved, if more and more Republicans step up, and especially with the elections coming up and Republicans start to feel the heat from voters back home about what's really at stake.
Trump responded yesterday on social media saying the Democrats are using, he called it, the Jeffrey Epstein hoax to try to deflect from their massive failure, in particular, the most recent one, the shutdown.
Everything's a hoax. You know, yeah. Everything's a hoax. When we saw evidence that Russia was trying to help Donald Trump in the 2016 election, that was a hoax. When the Mueller report came out, that was a hoax. Everything that Donald Trump doesn't like is a hoax. When it's a fake, when it's a poll that comes out that shows Donald Trump hurting or fading or doing poorly, it's a hoax. Whenever a newspaper or a network news story comes out, it's a hoax. And, you know, he could say it until he's blue in the face. But I guess as long as, you know, the Democrats are going to keep winning these elections, if that's the case, mm-hmm. and as long as the polls keep showing him in underwater, which seems to be the case, I don't think the voters back home will consider it a hoax.
So there's the old saying that it's not the crime that gets you, but the cover up. You know, all these controversies that are connected with the Trump administration, there's lots of different things. But why do you think the Epstein files is the one that's taken hold and it seems like it's not going to go away?
I think part of the reason is that Donald Trump from the beginning was calling for the release of it, which I never understood. If he knew or he assumed that he was in the files, why would he keep insisting? I guess because he felt that, Bill Clinton's name would come out and, everything is Bill Clinton's fault, Hillary Clinton's fault, Barack Obama's fault, and Joe Biden's fault, and Hunter Biden's fault. It's never Donald Trump's fault. So I think the fact that so many Republicans, Tucker Carlson, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the fact that so many of them have been calling for the release of it, and now that they have the opportunity to release it, and Donald Trump says, I'm not doing it, or at least I'm going to have Mike Johnson block it, then that just come back to bite him. And I think that's really what hurt him, because I think they built a case that we must see what's in those files. And then when they realize they have to release them, or when there's a public furor to make them force them to be released, and they don't comply, then it hurts more than it should have.
I found it so funny yesterday that the Democrats released three emails, and then a few hours later, the Republicans were like,
"500,000
here's 23,000 documents." I felt for the team at the New York Times who were like, "Oh dear," because now yesterday
No,
was
I
a
mean,
very busy day.
obviously, if they didn't think it was a big deal, they would probably ignore it. And usually, what Donald Trump does, he always accuses the Democrats of what they are guilty of. So, of course, Hunter Biden is lining his pockets when we know that the Trump children, when we see that the Trump children are benefiting from these crypto deals. And of course, when a reporter asked Caroline Leavitt whether there's a the Trump family is benefiting. She said, how dare you ask that question? That's usually been the response from Kristi Noem, from the head of the FBI, from Caroline Leavitt. How dare you ask the question? So they don't answer the question. They just say, by how dare you ask it, it means that we're not going to give you a straight answer on it.
We are talking national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And coming up, we're going to talk about the election results from that election that was just less than a week and a half ago. This is When All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The government shutdown has ended, and members of Congress on both sides of the aisle released documents related to Jeffrey Epstein and President Trump. Plus, just before voting to end the longest ever government shutdown, the House held a ceremony, the long-delayed swearing-in of Arizona Representative Adelita Grijalva. And that was all just yesterday. We still have election results to discuss from an election that was just a little over a week ago. We are talking about national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Thanks for being here, Ken.
Thanks, Amy. You mentioned Grijalva of New Mexico. I mean, talking about elections, she was elected like 2 months ago, and Mike Johnson refused to allow the swearing in because she would have been the signature that put them over the top for the release of the Epstein file. So the politics of elections is just, it's just remarkable what they do and what they get away with. And we keep saying it's unprecedented, unprecedented. It is. But ultimately, if you keep having elections like you did on Tuesday, and who knows if that momentum for the Democrats can last, but if you keep having those kind of results, this kind of ignoring political norm is not going to keep happening. There was an article in the A few articles in the papers not too long ago that said the Democrats are probably making a mistake by running against Trump, that they really should run on their record and what they intend to do, but instead they're running against Trump and it's not going to work. So meanwhile, fine, very good. And then comes the election day, and Democrats swept everywhere. They swept the election of New York City mayor, which was, I mean, everybody likes to say a democratic socialist, and he is the first Muslim mayor in a city there were more Jews living than anywhere else in the world, I think, and even more so than you know, Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. You have women being elected governors of New Jersey and for the first time in Virginia by double digits. You have a Democratic candidate for attorney general who in some emails talked about he wanted to put a bullet to the head of a Republican opponent that was released. I mean, it was just, you know, a horrific thing, especially in the aftermath of the Charlie Kirk assassination. And you see Jay Jones is talking about killing Republicans, and they say, oh my God, he's doomed. And yet he won anyway. And I think because there was even such a horrific thing what Jay Jones was accused of doing and did, it just, you know, was outweighed by the antipathy and the anger towards Donald Trump. And that was just pretty remarkable. But they seem to win everywhere. And the redistricting bill in California that Gavin Newsom put through, Proposition 50, basically his response to what went on in Texas. Well, it won overwhelmingly. And so it just seemed like on their side, on the Democrat side, on the anti-Trump side, that seemed to carry the day last Tuesday.
Well, we'll go through each of those things that happened last Tuesday, but I did want to just get your thoughts real quick. You know, before the election results came in, something else happened on Election Day last Tuesday. Former Vice President Dick Cheney passed away. He was one of the most powerful vice presidents the nation has ever seen in history. What do you think his legacy will be?
It depends. I mean, I've seen a lot of things lately that said, well, you know, even though, you know, first of all, let me just tell you, when I first met Dick Cheney, when he was a member of the House from Wyoming, a congressman, by the way, I mentioned earlier that Grijalva was from New Mexico. She's obviously from Arizona. But a lot of people consider that Arizona and New Mexico are two separate states. So I don't. So maybe that's where I made a mistake. So I apologize for that. But
got it.
So Dick Cheney was elected, and he was one of the best sources that reporters ever had on Capitol Hill. He was honest. He gave you a straight lowdown of what was going on, and people went flocked to him. So, yeah. And then the thought of him as a snarling, you know, warmonger, as George W. Bush's vice president, who got us into a war. You know, this is what the argument is. His reviews and his and what people thought of him soured tremendously. And then at the end, when he backed, you know, when he was very critical of Donald Trump and actually endorsed Kamala Harris, which was just incredible to think of when you think of it. Mm-hmm. So in other words, he was a very complicated guy. You're absolutely right. I think he was the most powerful vice president in history. George W. Bush took him on as VP because he needed that foreign policy gravitas that Bush didn't have. But not only did he have this gravitas, he had connections as former Secretary of Defense, as the White House Chief of Staff, so much that he basically ran the show after 9/11. So there are a lot of people who will never forgive him for what the United States did in the so-called world war on terror. There are other people who say that he helped keep us safe after the calamity of 9/11. So it's a mixed bag. And I see both sides completely.
All right. Well, let's move back to the blue wave that happened last Tuesday. New York City mayor-elect Zoran Mondami defeated former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and to win the mayoral election. Let's listen.
Tonight, you have delivered a mandate for change, a mandate for a city we can afford. New York will remain a city of immigrants, a city built by immigrants, powered by immigrants. And as of tonight, led by an immigrant.
And his victory speech also included this message to President Trump.
So hear me, President Trump, when I say this, to get to any of us, you will have to get through all of us.
Ken, what did you think of that victory speech?
Well, I was actually really, I remember watching it live when he gave it, and I don't remember a more effective or more dramatic anti-Trump speech from any politician in ever. I mean, he just didn't hold back. I mean, basically his whole election was not, you know, the kind of Democratic namby-pamby stuff that you often hear saying, well, you know, we could do this, we could do that. I mean, he didn't back down about any of his views, and some of his views are extremely controversial, especially regarding the state of Israel and whether it should exist. But the thing also is that Andrew Cuomo, I mean, was a failure as a governor who resigned because of sex harassment charges. He had a questionable response to the pandemic. The pandemic where he may have doctored some numbers. So a lot of it, I mean, if he was the alternative, if Andrew Cuomo was the alternative, then it was easy to vote for Mamdani. So it was just fascinating to watch. He didn't hold back. He was very strong. He came up. He's proposing these things that I don't know if they're realistic. Free bus service. You know, I mean, when I was in fourth grade, I ran for president of my class, and I promised free candy. Now I don't know if I could have given free candy, but that certainly is more doable than free buses around New York City. So I don't know if what he's saying is doable. But the fact is, there was an anger, a really anger about what was not happening, about the expense, the unaffordability of living in New York City. And he got a lot of young voters. And that seems to be what the Democratic Party is now all about, whether there's an age battle going on between the old guard, you know, mm-hmm. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and things like that. And younger people said, you know, we've had enough of this.
What do you think the Democrats overall throughout the country can learn from this mayor's race in New York City? Do you think they can have some takeaways?
Well, I think Republicans would love for Zohran Mamdani to be the spokesperson for the Democratic Party. But no, I think it was just singular for New York City, because mm-hmm. what Abigail Spanberger promised in Virginia, what Mikey Yasherel promised in New Jersey, was basically moderation and centrist government compared to what Mamdani was promising in New York City. So I think it was really just, you know, a New York City message that really we've never ever seen before.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. So moving on to an election night that could be called Ladies' Night when it came to the major gubernatorial elections that we watched in New Jersey and Virginia. A win in New Jersey and a win in Virginia, first female governors there. And you just mentioned that both women are centrist.
Well, second female in New Jersey, because that was Christy Whitman, but she was the first Democratic governor in New Jersey.
Yes.
And the first female in Virginia, yes.
Yes, you are an encyclopedia of all the facts. All right, I got it. So then both women are centrist Democrats, and they have backgrounds with the military and national security. So what do their wins say about those states versus, I guess, what happened in New York City? Yeah.
Well, look, this is not Ohio. I mean, this is not Republican states. Clearly, Virginia, Virginia has a history of voting for governor of the opposite party in the White House, who's in the White House. If Trump is in the White House, you elect a Democrat for governor. If Biden's in the White House, you elect a Republican for governor. That's usually the history of it. But a lot of people thought that the election was going to be close. It was double digits in New Jersey. It was supposed to be very close. Donald Trump, New Jersey was one of Donald Trump's best states for coming back between 2016 and 2024. It was a tremendous increase in Trump's numbers. It showed that he and the Republican candidate, Jack Cittarelli, was touched a chord in New Jersey. So a lot of people thought that was going to be very close, and it wasn't. I think if the Democrats want to send out a message of how to run, I think what the two women did in their victories in New Jersey and Virginia showed that that's the way to do it. It's not such much a Mamdani thing. It's just that running about anti-Trump and what the people want and regarding affordable health care, affordable groceries, affordable utilities, And they argued for that, and it seemed to be very, very successful.
Another big victory for the Democrats was the passage of California's Proposition 50, which will allow them to draw new congressional districts for the 2026 through 2030 elections, which could flip five Republican House seats to the Democrats in California. And it's been done in response to President Trump's push in Texas to redistrict there. How big of a gamble was this on a part of Governor Gavin Newsom there to give this a try on with Prop 50?
Well, you know something, I had been very dismissive of Gavin Newsom for the past couple of years, thinking that, well, this is, you know, the left coast, he's a pretty boy, he's an elitist. I didn't think that's what the Democratic Party wants, but he had a way of getting under Trump's skin with these fake videos, basically mocking everything Trump did. I mean, if you haven't seen it, just search Gavin Newsom on YouTube, and they're hysterical because, I mean, all the stuff that Trump does with a straight face, Newsom does, and then the Republicans say, oh, I can't believe Gavin Newsom would be so, you know, ridiculous.
Gavin Newsom, social media coordinator and AI generator on point. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, my God. Yeah. They should run for president. But anyway, look, one of the bugs I have about politics is redistricting. I mean, I think it's not, I don't like it. I think it cheats voters, it cheats democracy. And of course, both Democrats and Republicans have been doing this for years. Mm-hmm. It's not that long ago when Democrats owned state legislatures around the country and they drew the lines to favor them. So it's not, I'm not just picking on the Republicans right now, but to do it in the middle of a decade, you know, to do it because Donald Trump says, you know, we're probably going to lose the House in 2026. So maybe let's just redraw the lines right now. I mean, this is part of the attempted theft of the 2020 presidential election, that they're trying to do that with the House of Representatives. But having said that, if they're going to do it in Texas, if they're going to do it in Florida, if they're going to do it in Missouri and states around the country, Indiana, then what Gavin Newsom tried to accomplish and did accomplish in California was just, you know, I mean, you know, I remember, you know, when Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we should go higher.
No, when they go low, we go high. Yeah.
When they go low, we go high. That doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. I think because they're going to keep going low. And if you
when they go low, we go lower.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, this is, as they say, politics is not beanbag. You know, you just got to, the game, name of the game is winning, as Nancy Pelosi, by the way, we could talk about her too, as well, who's retiring, who's the most amazingly effective speaker. But if, you know, if you just want to get good headlines and satisfy good government types, or if you want to win, and Gavin Newsom clearly said, okay, we're going to win, and he did a very effective tit-for-tat in California.
I wanted to talk, just before we take the break, about Ohio's redistricting, because in Ohio, we had to redraw our map by law, because the last one didn't have bipartisan support. So we had to go back and redraw a map this year that was required. The map they ended up passing here in Ohio passed unanimously, but many Ohio Democrats are not happy with it. The Democrats that voted for it said it was the best they were going to get. So we went from 10 Republican districts and 5 Democratic districts. So now we'll have 12 Republican-leaning districts and 3 Democratic-leaning ones. And
that seems fair.
Yeah, well, this is but the Democrats who were on the committee voted for it. It passed 7-0 to say, because they said this was the best we were going to get. I guess, I don't know if behind the scenes they were presented with a 14-1 map or something. I have no idea. Yeah,
I just know they've been trying to get rid of up in Toledo. They've been trying to get rid of Marcy Kaptur for a million years. I think she's the longest serving woman in the history of the House. Yeah, I mean, this is what they do. And again, if you have the power, you use it to your advantage. I think redistricting is one of the real the things that just upsets me the most, because it's not a reflection of what the state is. I mean, North Carolina, for example, is basically a 50-50 state. The Democrats, Republicans, maybe more Republican, but not much more. And yet the way they're drawing the lines there, they're drawing you know, Democrats out of existence. And you can say what you want about what the Democrats tried to do in the early 1990s by drawing black majority districts, because blacks have been drawn out of congressional lines for so many years. So they tried to create districts that would benefit African-American candidates. But now the Supreme Court, you know, they're probably going to get rid of the Voting Rights Act or, you know, get rid of anything that would give some kind of advantage to minority districts. We've just gone backwards, you know, 50 years, and it's just heartbreaking. You know, if you just love politics, without forget about Democrats, Republicans, if you love and you believe in politics as the solution to what helps democracy, the way they're using the redistricting and gerrymandering does not help democracy in any way, shape, or form.
What do you make of the fact that 8 out of 10 Californians voted for it, though?
Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, I thought that was really high. Yeah.
I mean, because I was basically your vote. That's the only thing that was on the ballot. It was a ballot measure. And, I mean, could you imagine saying, oh, my God, that ballot measure? Who says that? But I think a lot of people there's so much anger. And I think the Democrats were sitting and taking it for the longest time because Republicans, you know, Donald Trump was doing, and he still does what he wants. There's no, Congress is not going to stand up to him. The Supreme Court doesn't stand up to him, although some lower courts have. And Democrats said enough is enough. So I think that's one of the reasons why you see the frustration with Chuck Schumer, because he seems to be like going along a little bit. Whereas the Alexandria Ocasio, you know, AOCs of the world and the more left wing of the Democratic Party says, we've just been having our head handed to us time after time after time, and enough is enough.
We're talking about national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And coming up, we're going to talk about some familiar names that are exiting and entering politics. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. One of the leading Democratic political figures of our time has announced her retirement. Another figure who is social media famous and has ties to the Kennedy dynasty is looking to throw his hat into the political arena. We're talking about national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Thanks again for being here, Ken.
Thank you, Amy.
So former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that her plan is to retire from Congress at the end of her term. How important has she been to the Democratic Party as a political force?
Well, it's not even, you know, when I think of Nancy Pelosi, I don't even think of 2025 or the 21st century. I think of history, and she may be the most powerful. I mean, you think of Sam Rayburn and Chip O'Neill and all these, you know, powerful speakers of the past. But the fact that she worked with Democratic presidents with very little margin of error, you know, very few with, you know, not like when Sam Rayburn was speaker, the Democrats had an overwhelming majority in Congress, whereas Nancy Pelosi never had that advantage. But, you know, the Affordable Care Act, you know, Obamacare wouldn't have happened without Nancy Pelosi. There were so many things that she, you know, the impeachment of Donald Trump, she fought it for the longest time, said the country's not ready for it. But when Donald Trump kept proving to the world that he was ready for impeachment, she made it happen. She's very, very effective. And I say that, look, but at the same time, she's 85 years old. Mm-hmm. And this is what the Democrats are still wrestling with. I mean, you know, the great white hope in Ohio for 2026 seems to be Sherrod Brown. But Sherrod Brown has been around for a long time, and he still will probably be the Democratic nominee for the Senate. But it seems like the Democratic Party is looking for young people, new blood, fresh blood. You mentioned the Kennedy family member, Jack Schlossberg, who is Caroline Kennedy's son, and of course, JFK's grandson. He's going to run for the House seat that that Democrats are giving up in Manhattan.
Back to Nancy Pelosi for just a second. When I think of her, I'm always going to remember her ripping up the State of the Union address. that's the image that pops into mind.
I mean, it was great, and he hated her. I mean, he just hated her because she stood up to him. And I can't think of I can't think of a woman in Congress. I can't think of a member of Congress who was so powerful, so effective. I mean, you know, like you think of Kevin McCarthy, who had bullets aimed at him, or arrows, I should say, arrows aimed at him from the beginning because, you know, one segment of the party or another didn't like him. But Nancy Pelosi just garnered respect and sometimes grudgingly, but she had the power. And, when the Democrats first won the House in 2006, she became Speaker. Then she lost it when Obama's numbers were terrible, then the Republicans regained the House. Then she gained it back in 2018. She accomplished things again, infrastructure, with no votes to spare. She helped pass some of Joe Biden's most important legislation. So, just remarkable, amazing to watch. As far as raising money, I mean, she raised a ton of money for the Democratic Party and still has that reputation. But again, you know, at 85.
Do you think there's more Democrats who need to follow her lead, or do you think some will?
Well, if they don't, they may be forced to do it. For example, in Massachusetts, Ed Markey, the senator, U.S. senator, who's been around for a long time and is really getting up there in age, he's been challenged by Congressman Moulton because he's just been around too long. In Maine, which is with Susan Collins is running for the Senate seat there, Janet Mills is the governor there, but she's she's old or she's not new blood, and there are a lot of Democrats said no, we need new blood. So it's interesting. There's people who have experience and knowledge and Rolodexes and things like that, but sometimes people are saying at the same time that their time has come and gone, and it's time for now. It's our turn. So that could be a big battleground in the 2026 Democratic primaries.
Now, Nancy Pelosi is retiring. Mitch McConnell is retiring. But then there's other older politicians that no one's asking to step down, like Bernie Sanders, for example. Everyone's wanting him to stay around. What do we make of that? Yeah, I know. What do you make of that?
Well, you know something, you could be old at 35 and young at 80. And I mean, that seems like I'm giving Bernie Sanders a way out. But he's still effective. He still holds hearings and he's still on top of his game. Mitch McConnell, obviously, is not on top of his game. Chuck Grassley, who's not up for the re-election this year, but he was elected 2 years ago, when he babbles a lot and when he runs Senate hearings. So there's some people that, regardless of age, they're old. I'm not going to tell Bernie Sanders, that he's too old to run and it doesn't to keep running. And there doesn't seem to be any sentiment in the Democratic Party said it's time for him to get out.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. While still pledging her support of Donald Trump, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has gone rogue in her criticism of the GOP and House Speaker Mike Johnson. She's been a vocal supporter of the release of the Epstein files, and she has been a supporter of parts of the Affordable Care Act. She also is making the rounds on shows. She's been on The View and Real Time with Bill Maher. Do you think she's positioning herself for a presidential run?
I don't know what she's doing.
You don't know what she's doing.
I really
don't.
And I'm fascinated by it. But yeah. I mean, she came to Congress a couple of terms ago with such a bizarre resume, and she talked about QAnon theories, and she was just really like, you know, Jewish space lasers. And I'm saying, my goodness, what is she doing and what is she saying? So, but suddenly she has a knack of making a name for herself, and she gets on, you know, just, you know, it's like a Nancy Mace in South Carolina. If there's a camera, you know, you can't get between her and the camera. And Marjorie Taylor Greene loves it. But the fact that she's standing up to Trump in so many ways, especially on the Epstein thing, and I don't know how long that is, but it's fascinating to watch. I don't know, there's some people saying that maybe she's going to run for the Senate next year against John Ossoff, who is probably the most vulnerable Democratic incumbent in the Senate. I can't imagine her winning. I mean, I can't imagine an anti-Trump Republican winning the Republican nomination for president if Donald Trump does allow free elections in 2028. But I don't know what to make of it, except I just don't blink when I see her. I just stare and say, I have no idea what she's doing.
All right. Well, if she isn't the nominee and Trump doesn't run for a third term, I mean, what do you think will happen here in 2028? I hate to talk about predicting 2028.
I mean, yeah, right, exactly. Who would have predicted? I mean, I was listening to my Talk of the Nation with Neil Conan before 2012, 2013. And we talk about the Republicans who are coming up, and Donald Trump's name never was mentioned. I mean, right. The thought of Donald Trump as president. So who knows? But, you know, if you're a vice president and you're a defender of the president, J.D. Vance has to be considered the front runner. Mm-hmm. Marco Rubio clearly wants it. I mean, there are a lot of, there's no shortage of who wants it. It's probably 10 times more people who want it on the Democratic side. But I don't know. I mean, it's just, you know, Josh Hawley of Missouri is talking about it.
I skipped over. I forgot to ask you about Schlossberg. So, because I mentioned him in the beginning.
Jack Schlossberg,
JFK, he's JFK's grandson, cousin of RFK Jr., and he wants to make a run for Congress. But he made his name on social media mostly for trolling his cousin, Health and Human Service Secretary, you know, RFK Jr. Yeah.
You talk about the Kennedy family. I mean, he is the most vocal Kennedy family member to rip apart RFK Jr. Mm-hmm. And what he's doing at HHS. It's just remarkable. But, you know, this is a very Democratic seat. It's the Manhattan. It's whoever wins the Democratic primary is guaranteed the election there. Other Democrats want it, but Schlossberg is photogenic. He has the name. I mean, not the Schlossberg name, but the mm-hmm. Kennedy name. And it'll be, again, it's part of the new wave of Democrats who are coming up. I mean, just because Mamdani, I mean, you know, Mamdani stands for one thing, and you know, Congressman Moulton of Massachusetts may stand for another thing, but they're young, and they're the new face of the Democratic Party. And, you know, if the old face of the Republican Party is Donald Trump, 2026 and 2028 will be fascinating to watch.
We have just a couple of minutes left. So now that the government shutdown has ended and we're back on the Epstein files, what do you think is going to be happening next here between now and the end of January, whenever we'll run out of funding again? What do you
predict? Well, I mean, we may have the same thing all over again. I think both sides think they learned a lesson. I think the Democrats learned a lesson, like, mm-hmm. well, if we did give up, if we did surrender, we're not going to do it again if we don't get anything of what we want in 2020, in January of 2026. And the Trump people say, look, you know, we can't, given the numbers and given the unpopularity of what our policies are, and given the fact that so many people are suffering and hungry, go to bed hungry, and not getting food stamps and the WIC payments and things like that, they may say, look, we've got to change our message. Mm-hmm. The question is whether the leaders, and meaning Donald Trump, hears those messages, and whether they just agree to accommodate them. But right now, Donald Trump feels he's invulnerable, and nothing stops him, And as long as he keeps getting away with it, why change?
Yeah, the end of January will be a different time as well, because they extended the SNAP benefits, so the SNAP part won't happen again. And there, you won't have the threat of air traffic controllers not being on the job at Thanksgiving. So I don't know.
True, but yeah. You also remember that the primary started in March of 2026. So the 2026 midterms will begin almost immediately as the clock strikes January 1st. Yeah. Does the clock ever strike January 1st?
I don't know.
No,
that's
not
anymore.
How clocks work, right? No.
Hey, I wanted to say happy birthday one more time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for being here on your birthday, and thanks for talking politics with us.
Thanks, Amy.
We've spent the hour talking national politics with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And if you missed any part of today's show, you can listen back at wosu.org/allsides. Subscribe to our podcast. Every episode is available for free in the WOSU mobile app. Also, be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Instagram. The Instagram handle is @AllSidesWOSU. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.